Welcome to the False Claims Act Insider, presented by Price Benowitz. With more than 15 years of experience as an attorney focusing on key TAM law, Tony Munter explores the risks and heroism involved in being a whistleblower alongside distinguished attorneys.
Jeb White, you're the once and now again president and CEO of Taxpayers Against Fraud. I guess a little bit like Nancy Pelosi, you have previous experience in the job and it's gotten tougher. Those of us who happen to be members of TAF are extremely grateful for you stepping in and doing this, especially since you left a partnership at a big firm to do it in the middle of COVID. But anyway, that's who Jeb is, and it's a real honor to be able to interview you. I don't suppose there's anything about the board meeting that you had for Taxpayers Against Fraud that you want to tell anyone about right now. But what do you think the general direction of TAF has to be going into a new administration and dealing with the many new laws that we're dealing with now? Is it more advocacy or supporting individual cases or working with members, or how do you see the sort of TAF, if you will, over the short term?
Sure. So, in the middle of a pandemic, a lot of money coming out of Congress right now, trillions of dollars. Just yesterday, President-elect Biden talked about another $1.9 trillion being injected into our economy. So, a lot of government dollars flowing out, which means increased opportunities for fraud, which means there's an increased need for organizations like TAF and attorneys like yourself. But we got to do a better job of telling that story about the role of key TAM attorneys and whistleblowers and why they are so important, and that there is an avenue for employees who are recognizing fraud inside of corporate walls to step outside and highlight that fraud for key TAM attorneys and the government. So our role is probably right now, right? TAF was built for problems like this, or opportunities like this, or issues of increased government spending. So this is what we were made for 30, 40 years ago. It's good to be back. With these challenges comes great opportunity for people to do the right thing. To tell our story is our main mission right now, to really make sure that people are aware of the important role that whistleblower attorneys like yourself play, and whistleblowers in general.
Well, I think it's interesting because I was looking at your resume, and unless I'm wrong, most of the time when you were first CEO of TAF, we didn't have the SEC whistleblower program. We didn't have the CFTC whistleblower program. There is a Transportation Safety Act whistleblower program, which hasn't done much yet. So I don't know. I'm sure TAF gets some of the credit for advocating that there be more whistleblower programs. But at the same time, there's more law for everybody to understand and follow. And the job's got to be more complicated for you as it is for most whistleblower lawyers right now, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I joined Taxpayers Against Fraud in 2004, one of our friends in the Key TAM bar took me out to lunch, and he said, what you should do is read every single published circuit court opinion about the False Claims Act. And I did it over the course of 30 days. That would be hard, right? That would be a full-time job for a year. Yeah. But back then, I did it in 30 days.
That would take a long
time. Yeah. Back then, you could do it in 30 days. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember there was this one book back in the day, and it like compiled everything. And now there's 20 books, and it's gotten pretty extensive. And most of that's good. I mean, most of that, I think, has given more opportunities for whistleblowers. But I'm sure you're concerned, as I am, about some of the defense, best defense cases, or best interpretations, I should say, of cases that have made us have to fight back all the time. I guess this is a pet peeve of mine, but you know, this HHS working group was announced, and there was a lot of noise made about there being only defense bar attorneys on it. That didn't turn out to be true. But they're constantly attacking whistleblowers as being greedy. And if there's one thing that disturbs me, it's the idea that only whistleblowers are supposed to be, you know, Mahatma Gandhi or something. And I don't know how we fight that. I mean, I really don't. I mean, we keep getting attacked for our people doing what the law says and reporting stuff and expecting to be paid for it, being told that that's somehow un-American. You know, what do you do about that? Because they're coming for us on that one, I
think. Sure, sure. You know, the best way to fight stories like that is with the truth, right? So showcasing and spotlighting the real stories of the whistleblowers and their stories of fighting back against companies doing the wrong thing is the way you push back on that. You know, there's so many amazing, inspiring stories of whistleblowers who called your office or my office over the years because they stood up to try to do the right thing, and they were alienated, isolated, and terminated. And then they called us to try to get their jobs back, not even aware of the False Claims Act or there's some kind of reward structure, right? So, you know, I think we have to do a better job as a community of attorneys and whistleblowers in highlighting the reality of how these stories come to light, right? That oftentimes they are kind of the single candle in a dark room inside the corporation. You know, I was in private practice for the last 10 years before coming back, and I was always amazed how often my client was the only relator or one of just a few relators in a huge mm-hmm. company trying to stand up and do the right thing.
Yeah, you were in private practice, and I noticed that at least in one of your profiles, you took a case to the Supreme Court. Was that a False Claims Act case,
I worked on a number of cases where I was, you know, brought in to help counsel them in arguments. My cases weren't brought to the Supreme Court, but I was there, you know, amicus or to help moot them or work with the Solicitor General's office and help prepare the arguments. Yeah,
because there aren't that many. There's only maybe. In terms of Supreme Court decisions, I don't think there's maybe one a year of cases. So that did catch my eye. Obviously, you'd be involved, I would think, in any Supreme Court case now as president of TAF. Somebody would want your help, I would think, on it. What are you looking for right now in terms of new area we could go after? There was a story just today. It's just breaking on the news today about $5 million going to a PPP money going to payday loan makers, which I think is a testament to how loose the regulations were with the PPP program. There's also under investigation by the SEC for royalty rights. These aren't things that normally people associate with whistleblower laws, but if you think about it, you know, there could be government royalties attached to oil and gas leases. So that could also go as a False Claims Act case. I mean, traditionally it's all been healthcare, but do you think we're going to see any expansion in the areas of False Claims Act litigation?
Yeah. You know, it's the old story, the bank robber, why did you rob the bank? Well, that's where the money is, right? So money is traditionally the False Claims Act cases have been largely healthcare cases because that's where the money is. But under the recent stimulus bills, money's flowing everywhere. And where money flows, fraud follows. And I think you're absolutely right. There's going to be False Claims Act cases in all areas that touches our economy or touches government dollars. And government money is everywhere. As you said, Tony, I mean, oil royalties. If you can name an industry, we can point to a case where there was a False Claims Act case.
Well, that's good. Do you see any difference? I guess it's a little early to tell, but Merrick Garland is nominated to be the Attorney General. He is widely respected in the legal community, but in particular, I think he wrote a dissent in a famous False Claims Act case that was actually decided by Judge Roberts the other way. But I guess it's fair to say we expect a fair shake out of the upcoming Department of Justice I personally haven't seen much in terms of lying U.S. attorneys or anything like that that you could point to as being, you know, I mean, they generally look at the facts of the case and give us a fair shake, I think. But I think there'll be a little more confidence amongst the general whistleblowing public maybe going forward. Do you think that's fair to say? Or?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the Attorney General Barr in 1987 wrote a memo when he was with the Justice Department in which he questioned the constitutionality of the whistleblower provisions in the False Claims Act. By contrast, Merrick Garland, as you said, wrote a dissent in this Totten case in which he called the False Claims Act a broad anti-fraud statute, right, in supporting a broad reading of the False Claims Act. So from their core, I think they come across very differently when it comes to the False Claims Act. But you put your finger on it. You know, our day-to-day interactions at the Justice Department have remained the same for many, many years. You know, Deputy Assistant Attorney General Michael Granson's been there for years. We have great relationships with him. He remains there. Received Taxpayers Against Fraud Honest Abe Integrity Government Award this year for his hard work over the last 20 something years defending the False Claims Act against opponents that looked to tear it apart. And then, you know, Director of the Civil Frauds, Jamie Yavelberg, remains there, as does her co-deputy directors, Andy Mao and Colin Huntley. So, you know, we know the people who work there. They are apolitical. They're not driven by political whims of changing administrations. They've been there through people on the left, people on the right, people who support the False Claims Act, and people who don't. So I think the best thing about our world is that we have certainty that we're going to get a fair, reasonable shake from the Justice Department, that they are dedicated public servants who are committed to making sure the False Claims Act is read broadly and correctly. So it's the change in the AG, I think, goes in a better direction for us. But when push comes to shove, I think it really doesn't matter for us.
Okay, that's good to know. Now, is Taft's role, I mean, Taft has files amicus briefs and it supports individual litigation, and it's an unbelievably valuable resource if you happen to practice this kind of law, because you have what amounts to a back office law firm of people who are expert in a really esoteric area of law that you can share ideas with and all that. But do you see us getting into more advocacy over the next year or two? I'm thinking, obviously, with respect to Escobar and the unfortunate interpretations that the defense bar keeps putting on it, maybe 9B issues. You know, I'm sure you have plenty of pet peeves of what we could be attacking. Do you see any more legislation coming out or anything like that that we should be on the lookout and advocating for?
Yeah. So, you know, last time I was with Taxpayers Against Fraud was during the FARA amendments of 2009, yeah. And then Obamacare in 2010. There were important amendments that happened during that time that I was had the great opportunity to educate senators and congressmen about why those amendments were so important. That needs to come up again, right? As you said, there was a Supreme Court decision, the Escobar decision, that arguably ripped a hole into the False Claims Act liability provisions when it comes to certain cases. Government dismissal is a big concern. Those are issues that Senator Grassley has identified as something that he'd like to fix. He has put forward legislation this last summer. I'm sure it's going to find its way to the Senate again, because these are issues that matter to fraud enforcement, right? So if there are issues that are going to allow liability loopholes, Senator Grassley, for the last 40 years, has been protecting the False Claims Act. So my role is to spotlight the need for that, to educate other congressmen and senators who aren't as up to speed on the law as Senator Grassley is, to answer questions that they have. Just like last time, you know, I had an opportunity to talk about why whistleblower protections and provisions were needed in the SEC and CFTC and IRS. You know, all of that is just a matter of educating. It's not really lobbying or advocacy, it's about educating the realities of what we're seeing there. These cases involving fraud on the government are not just limited to the government. You know, if they're ripping off Medicare, they're ripping off private insurance. They are equal opportunity offenders and defrauders oftentimes. So Making sure that those fraud schemes are reachable by the law is probably my most important goal. Making sure that whistleblowers are protected and that there's an avenue to recover those funds and that fraud schemes are brought to light is a matter of educating people on the Hill, but also educating the public so that when somebody is sitting behind a corporate wall and they're trying to stand up to do the right thing and they are fired, they at some point see something in the paper and say, wait a second, I was fired because I stood up for this, right? Exactly what's happening at this other company is happening at my company. We want to encourage those people to step forward. And when they do, we want them to have some kind of protection so that they are protected under the law and they have some avenue to get redress. So that's what the False Claims Act is about. It's the SEC, the IRS, CFTC, whistleblower statutes, and increasingly a number of states are passing in these laws to ensure that state dollars are protected as well. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff happening right now in so many different areas. It's a great time to be back.
Well, I'm glad for you that way. I think we're up to like 30 states now. I could have the number wrong. We have half of Pennsylvania between like a Philadelphia and an Allegheny County. Funny. I think there's a bill in Ohio, which comes up every one. I'll never quite get there. That would be helpful. But we also, there's private insurance in Illinois and California and tax in at least New York. Some states that need a False Claims Act. But it's, you know, it's slowly creeping. We're so sort of slowly creeping into every state legislature, which is a good thing. I think we've only really lost New Hampshire, which has a pretty restrictive law after passing a decent False Claims Act. So there's a lot of work to do on the state level, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've had the pleasure of testifying in front of a lot of state legislators over the years, and it's interesting to hear the opponent's side, but the reality is red states, blue states, big states, small states, they all have state False Claims Acts. It's a rare exception. In my home state of Pennsylvania, I'm currently sitting 45 minutes from the state capitol, and it pains me that I'm sitting in a state that can't seem to get a state False Claims Act together. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's just you start pointing to the success that other states are seeing, and there comes a tipping point where people, it's hard to argue the other side when the reality is you see other states protecting their limited dollars and getting recoveries that your state's missing out on. So there will come a tipping point where we'll have all 50 states without a doubt.
I think so. I happen to know a state senator in Pennsylvania who'd be very sympathetic. So remind me to give you the contact information.
Great, absolutely.
But every state we get, I think is a big help, obviously. I'm surprised we haven't seen as much standalone state False Claims Act cases. And I say that because it's always occurred to me that if you're an attorney general and, you know, you don't work for the administration of a state usually. Usually you're a separate organization and you're a little less restrained by the vagaries of the so-called client. So I've always been surprised that that hasn't become even more active. And maybe we all need to think about looking at state-only False Claims Act cases a little more, even though obviously a nationwide scheme and a big payday is hard to ignore. But it would be nice to get a Pennsylvania-wide state False Claims Act.
Absolutely.
Do you think they're going to look at these provisions like New York State has for a state tax False Claims Act, or the dollar's a little tricky on that for a smaller state? I mean, New York State, arguably, you could owe a lot of, you know, you could cheat New York State out of a lot of tax money because it's, you know, you got a lot of very wealthy people and big businesses there. Maybe that's not the case for other states.
That's a good point. You know, DC on December 1st followed New York's lead on this point, right? So they removed the tax bar, and on where there's damages of $350,000 or more, you can use the DC False Claims Act to help recover those funds. I think that's a great test case for small jurisdictions to look at, right? DC, the District of Columbia, a lone city saying, we want to protect our tax dollars. For me, it makes more sense for small states to do this, right? They have limited resources, prosecutorial wise. This is a way to supplement their limited resources by deputizing private citizens to bring cases on behalf of their jurisdiction to recover tax dollars. It makes tremendous sense for small jurisdictions to say, wait a second, we're missing out here. We're so inundated with cases involving increased government spending over here, and we're missing dollars on the back end because they're not coming in through tax revenue. I think it makes tremendous sense for these small jurisdictions to pass these laws.
Okay, that's good. Hopefully we'll see some of that. That'd be great. Do you know historically what the bar was for taxes on the original False Claims Act federally? I know it's there. I just don't know why it's there. Do you have any idea what that was about?
I know some of the backstory. So, you know, in 86, Senator Grassley recognized there was going to be a big push from the defense bar at the time, right? Because this was passed during the times of the $900 hammers and the $20,000 toilet seats. I think he didn't want to fight the war on multiple fronts. So you bring in the tax defense bar. If you lift the tax bar, and I thought he said, you know, let's fight the war here. It hasn't happened on the federal side. I think there's some a lot of eyes looking at New York right now to see how it's going to play out there. This world in which the defense argued that the world would fall if the tax bar is removed simply hasn't happened in New York. It's used judiciously. It was used to bring a huge case against Sprint for multi-million dollars. So people are looking at New York, and now they can look at DC to see what actually happens when you don't lift the tax bar, but modify the tax bar to go after the big tax cheats.
Okay. Hopefully we'll see some progress on that, because obviously it would be great if other states adopted it. Yeah. I want to give you an opportunity to do an ad for TAF. I can just say that as a member, it's been an invaluable resource to me. I know you wouldn't have been president the first time, much less come back to do it again, if you didn't think it was worth doing. But if you're a aspiring whistleblower lawyer and you want to know what to do in this world, why would you pony up the money to come to TAF?
So I try to say this objectively as possible, but if you're practicing in the QI-TAM attorney or QI-TAM world without being a member of TAF, it might be malpractice. It taps you into 400 other attorneys that specialize into this really nuanced area of the law, in which you get real-time information about what's happening in the case law and on Capitol Hill and the Justice Department. It not only shortens your learning curve, but puts you in contact with other attorneys. It makes you, in a sense, a part of a large law firm, a multi-state law firm, with people who have been practicing in this area for many, many years. So it's a very small membership due, but the rewards and the value that you receive from the organization really goes well beyond just being a bar association. So, you know, Taxpayers Against Fraud, people always ask, are you guys a bar association? I think the answer is yes. And oftentimes if you're practicing in the QI-TAM world without being a member of TAF, it really is malpractice, because it puts you in connection with 400 other attorneys that specialize in this area. And in essence, it makes you part of a national QI-TAM law firm. So you have 400 other attorneys. Many of them have been practicing in this area for many, many years. You're able to leverage the resources and the knowledge of so many other attorneys. Many of them are former U.S. attorneys or AUSAs or main justice or agency officials who are there to help you, guide you. Of course, from a organization standpoint, we provide a lot of resources like case law and conferences and CLEs, but we also let you know what's happening on Capitol Hill and then the news media. So it is not a bar association. I view it as a movement of dedicated change agents who are practicing in the QI-TAM arena. So it's a pleasure and an honor to be back with a lot of my friends at Taxpayers Against Fraud. But if you are practicing in this area, we want you inside of the tent, not outside of the tent making bad case law. So please join us. The membership fees are extremely reasonable in the amount of value you get back. It goes well beyond the dollar price. So make sure you reach out to us at taf.org if you're interested.
Okay. I appreciate it. I appreciate your time and I appreciate all the work you do for us. And I would just say as a member, it's pretty collegial. I mean, we're all looking for separate cases, but I've never had a TAF member turn me down on a question. And you know, they can be pretty tough questions to figure out and take time to answer. And it's just a great group to be a member of. So I do appreciate it.
Amen. I appreciate that, Tony.
All right. Take it easy, Jeb. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the False Claims Act Insider. Be sure to check back next week for more insights into the world of whistleblower and QITAM law with your host, Tony Munter. All episodes can be streamed on PriceBenowitz.com along with your favorite streaming platforms.